I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome to the Fried Egg Golf Podcast. I'm Garrett Morrison, and today, Michael Bamberger is on the show. The occasion is the republication of Michael's great book, To the Links Land. 30th anniversary edition of this book is going on sale next week. It's currently available for pre-order, and I highly recommend that you get yourself a copy. This is one of those golf books that you have to read. It'll put you under its spell, draw you into its world, and rekindle your enthusiasm for the game. It's been doing that for the past three decades for readers, and I'm sure it will continue to do it for many more decades. Basically, the book is an account of Michael Bamberger's quest to find the soul of the game in Europe in 1991. First, he caddies on the European Tour for Peter Teravainen and crosses paths with players like Ian Woosnam and Seve Ballesteros. Then he sets off with his then-new wife on a personal journey through Scotland to play links golf. So that's the subject of my conversation with Michael today. But really, this is just an opportunity, an excuse to talk to one of my writing idols, somebody whose byline I've followed since I was a teenager. Michael is one of the most distinctive sports writers, right? You could put a paragraph of his in front of me and I'd be able to link it to him almost immediately because his voice is so individual. So this is a big deal for me to get to interview him. He joined me from an outdoor setting, so you'll hear some sounds of nature in the recording. I like to think this provides some uniqueness. And honestly, I'm just impressed that he was able to set up a hotspot that actually kept us connected. So big thanks to Michael. That interview is coming up. Now, somewhat appropriately, this episode is brought to you by Golf in Ireland. If you want to take a To the Links Land style odyssey, the island of Ireland is one of the best choices for a destination. It's a golfer's paradise with over 400 courses and one-third of the world's true links. Ireland also has exceptional championship courses surrounded by epic landscapes. These include Royal County Down and Royal Portrush. A portion of the Fried Egg team is actually visiting Northern Ireland and seeing those spots right now. You'll also be able to see both courses on TV in the next couple of years. This September, County Down will host the Amgen Irish Open, and in 2025, the Open Championship will go back to Portrush. If you decide to go to some of these courses, you'll also discover some wonderful hospitality. There's no better place to finish a day of golf than the confines of a great pub, where you can relax and make new friends. All you got to do to start planning your trip is go to ireland.com/golf. Again, that's ireland.com/golf. All right, let's get to my interview with Michael Bamberger. All right, I'm here with Michael Bamberger. Michael, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Here is a relative term.
Describe where you are right now, in fact.
Well, I'm at the Country Club of Winter Haven, Winter Haven, Florida. It's a Reese Jones course designed with another fellow whose name I can't recall. And it is just a lovely setting. I think the Red Sox maybe used to train here. I know years ago I was here for baseball. And there's an Epsom Tour event. For those who don't know, the Epsom Tour is what Corn Ferry is to the PGA Tour. Not Corn Ferry. Is that what they call it now? Corn Ferry?
Yeah.
What Corn Ferry is to the PGA Tour, Epsom is to the LPGA Tour. And I was lucky enough to be invited to play in a pro-am today, and that's what I'm going to do.
Excellent.
I was also lucky to be invited onto this Garrett Morrison podcast. Someone actually seems to read a lot of books based on the bookshelves behind you, so thanks so much for having me.
Well, we were just joking about this before the podcast came on, and I told you that I'd point my camera at the books just to fool people into thinking that I'm smart, but those books are all for show. But one book that I have read is To the Links Land, and it's being republished very soon here. Can you give me an idea of why it's being republished now?
It's being republished only because I've got a wildly enthusiastic young editor named Jofie, J-O-F-I-E, who works for Simon & Schuster. And he's done so well at Simon & Schuster that they've given him his own imprint. And the imprint is called Avid Reader Press. And so he has some liberty to do things that he wants to do, including republishing super obscure golf books from his childhood that he would like to still see have life. That would be the short version.
I'm not sure that To the Lynx Land is super obscure at this point, but we will get into that. Why don't we go back to the beginning of this project? You know, it says the 30th anniversary edition, but I think it's in fact the 32nd anniversary of the publication and the 33rd anniversary of this endeavor that you undertook. So tell me about where you were in your life when you decided to take on the project that would become To the Lynx Land.
You had a high math SAT score, didn't you?
I mean, my verbal score was a little bit higher.
I see what you're doing here. In 1990, my wife Christine and I got married. I was a baseball writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, not a very good one, and Christine was a advertising executive in New York, and we got married on Shelter Island on Long Island, and we were looking to do something adventurous when we could, while we could, before mortgage and kids and all those other things. And I had already caddied once on the PGA Tour and written a book about that. And I was enamored with the European Tour. I read Golf World very closely, and Golf World covered the European Tour well. And it was Seve at the height of his powers, Olathabal, Woosnam, Nick Faldo, Bernhard Langer, and, you know, Colin Montgomery and various supporting characters, and I'm using the word intentionally, playing. So I thought if I could somehow hook onto that tour and caddy there and caddy in these national championships in Belgium and Italy and Ireland and Portugal and Scotland and other places, how fun would that be? And what a great way to get our married life off to a start. So I wrote a letter to a Yale grad who was playing the European Tour with middling success named Peter Teravainen, and he was willing to take me on an experimental basis. And on that basis, off we went. I took a leave from my job, and Christine quit hers, and as newlyweds, off we went on this adventure, really having no idea where we were going or what it would be like or how long it would last with Peter or anything else.
Was it part of the plan from the beginning to end up leaving the European Tour at the Scottish Open and go on this journey across Scotland playing golf yourself? Was that part of the concept from the beginning?
I think so. You know, I'd really have to go back in time, but that sounds right, because I do remember writing out a schedule, or maybe photocopying a schedule and putting it in my wallet. And I think it did conclude with the British Open in mid-July. And then after that, we would go to Scotland. So yes. To the degree we had a plan, yes, I think that was the plan.
Well, I'm curious about that because the book has this really interesting structure where it's basically two parts. One part is caddying on the European Tour, and the next part is going through Scotland on this kind of magical, wonderful journey of Lynx golf. I wonder, you know, it makes it such a great and rich book that way, but I wonder why you didn't just write a book about caddying on the European Tour or just write a book about playing golf in Scotland, because those would have been maybe the conventional ways to go. Those seem like maybe two different books on their own, but you've put them together here. I wonder why you did that.
Yeah, it's a terrific question, and I don't have an answer, except for that, you know, the whole thing was the spirit of adventure, and we would go where we would go. And I guess in part I'd done the caddying thing and written about it once, so I didn't want to do that again. I was always very moved by Michael Murphy's Golf in the Kingdom, where he explores, you know, semi-fictionally his own golf in Scotland. And I thought, how neat would it be if I could try to do something similar in a nonfiction way? I didn't have a Shivas Irons in mind at all, but I did have in mind the idea of exploring Lynx golf in Scotland. So yes, you're right. It was It's sort of two books in one, but it's kind of a skinny book to begin with. For those who don't like long books, this one's not. But those are good questions, which I have no answer, except that, as they say, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, I mean, I think it was a great idea. I love that the book is these two things at once, because what you're tempted to do is kind of compare and contrast them. And, you know, as you wrote the book, did you, you know, you don't compare and contrast them in a kind of pat way where you say, this is the real spirit of golf, journeying through Scotland, and the European tour is, or professional golf is, some kind of bastardized version of it. You're not that simplistic about it. But, you know, as you were writing it, did you come up with a kind of working theory about how these two sides of golf relate to each other, I guess?
Well, I never thought about it as you're framing it until this conversation, but I would definitely say the spirit of golf on the European tour as I experienced it, and the spirit of golf as amateurs played it in Scotland, there was a great connection between the two. Now today, if you were trying to do something similar about, let's say, LIV golf or even the PGA tour versus, you know, amateur golf at Ely, it would feel very different, but in that period, it didn't. The European tour was rough hewn, and what can I do to stay out here and survive? And golf in Scotland was inexpensive and brown and hard in the couple different senses. So I felt one paved the way to the other. And as I'm thinking about your question, and it's really an interesting one, I think I could take what I learned about golf, caddying for Peter Turvane and seeing the European Tour up close, and try to apply it to some degree to my own golf. So I think one paved the way for the other.
Well, let's dig in a little bit with your experience on the European Tour. For those who are familiar with the DP World Tour, as it's called now in the 21st century, how would you say it was different about 30 years ago?
Well, it's night and day. I don't really know much about the DP World Tour, except for that it's all over the place. I'm not saying that in a pejorative way, it just is. And even in 91, when I was over there, I think they did have one scheduled event in Saudi Arabia, and I believe it was canceled because of the Gulf War. I'm nearly certain of that, although I really would have to look it up to check. But for the most part, the European Tour was played, this will shock you, Garrett, in Europe. The currencies were different in every country because there was no EU. Travel was rough. Christine and I traveled by overnight train, which was great. There was overnight ferries. There were overnight bus rides. There were hire cars. There were caravans. There were, you know, all sorts of different ways of getting around. Some players would occasionally caddy for themselves or push a trolley. Seve was out there, and Seve was a golfing god, but he was propped up by all these working-class kids who turned pro at 18, guys like Richard Boxall and David Faraday and Robert Lee. You know, because you can't have a star without a supporting cast, and it had one. So it was, I would say, you know, the conditions were often semi-primitive by American standards, the driving ranges and the course and the travel and everything else, the hotels, the band of caddies was a bunch of characters, you know, everyone was sort of scraping by. And we were too, Christine and I were, you know, even though, you know, we had some cushion, but we were trying to make it based on what I was making from Peter as his caddy. Night and day is the short answer. I don't think you can even compare the two.
You chose Peter Teravainen as your subject / employer. Why did you do that? Did you have a pre-existing connection with him?
No, and chose would be a wild overstatement. You know, I begged him to let me come on for a couple of weeks. And it's in the book. I think he said he was going to give me a 2-week trial, maybe a 3-week one, and then we'll see how it goes. He didn't promise anything beyond that. To my great fortune, he made the cuts in both events, despite my broad ineptitude, but I often talk about my broad ineptitude, but some, you know, there was some connection for us as caddy and player as well. I was aware of him as an American player, as someone, you know, probably the, I would say certainly the best golfer in the history of the Yale University, golf team. I could easily put up with Peter's quirks. I enjoyed him. He was pathologically frugal and he had all sorts of interesting theories, and he needed an audience as a receptor for these theories. Like, he'd hit a good shot and then he'd hit another shot, or he'd stiff a shot and then he'd make a six footer. And once he said, good shots must come in groups of two. And I've run with that ever since. As a matter of fact, I saw CC Sabathia, the great left-hander, yesterday at Bay Hill. He's playing in a pro-am and he drove it a mile and then he stiffed a wedge and then he made the putt. Well, this guy's always going to drive it a mile, but it was the wedge and the putt. And I said, yeah, I used to caddy for a guy who said good shots must come in groups of two. And Sabathia says, yeah, I like that. But Peter always had things like that going on because he's super smart and verbal in a quirky kind of way. And, I didn't choose. There was one guy that I had a path that I could maybe write to. He didn't know me from Adam. And he was willing to take me on, on this experimental basis. And I'm not going to say we hit it off, but we did okay. Okay enough that he wasn't going to fire me.
Teravainen has these two sides to his character, it seems to me, from your portrait of him in your book. On the one hand, there is a mystical side to him. You know, he's you don't make much of it in the book, but he's starting to get into Buddhism. On the other hand, he's a very black and white kind of person, it seems. Economics major, somebody who is very into numbers, and like it's either good or it's bad. There's no in between. You know, golf is a matter of kind of figuring out the numbers. And was he kind of struggling between those two poles as you were working with him?
Yeah, great question. And I have to say, it brings up something right away when you say, you know, black and white, yes or no, left or right. So I was caddying for him at the Italian Open, and he drives it well. And we're looking at the pin sheet. It doesn't, the green's a two-tiered green. And then it's got a gentle slope in the middle. And Peter says, go up to the green and tell me where the pin is. It's either on the back plateau or the front plateau. And I come back and say, yeah, it's in the middle. And Peter says, it's not in the middle. It's either on the back plateau, I'm overstating here, but this is basically how one, back plateau or the front plateau. Can't be in the middle. I said, Peter, I don't know how to answer your question. It's in the middle. And he's like, he hits it on the green, two putts. He comes off the green. He was like, yeah, you're right. It was in the middle. But it was like so memorable. Here we are 32 years later, because it was so rare for him to agree that it wasn't one or the other, like it often was with him. Once I told him I often cite this, I don't know why. My wife, Christine and I were staying in a place where you could cook breakfast for yourself. And I said, no matter how good the eggs are, wherever you're eating, they'll never be like the eggs you eat at home. And Peter said, yeah, that's right. And for Peter to casually agree with anything was so rare, because he could find problems with anything because he was so smart and so analytical. So that always stuck. All these years later, that sticks with me. And I think about it all the time when I cook eggs at home, because I like them. I like to cook on intense heat, and I like the edges with a lot of butter. I know I can hear my wife say, you know, turn on the fan right now. And I like the edges to be crispy and brown. And then sometimes I'll flip them over with no heat on. But the point is, you can't go to a diner and get that. I know this will bring to mind for some people the Larry David episode where he goes to the country club with his own eggs. And I have to say, I can totally understand, because the quality of the eggs that you bring from home are very, very likely to be better than the quality of the eggs that the country club is going to have.
Oh my gosh. We need to have an egg section of this podcast now, especially considering it is the Fried Egg Golf Podcast. That's a wonderful story. In any case, these aspects of Teravainen's character were so interesting to me. And it seemed like he was, you know, to an extent, when you were working with him, he was not quite at peace, right? He hadn't won yet. There was some struggle going on with him. And that's what so many golfers go through, where they want things to be certain. They want things to be black and white. They know they can, if they just figure it out, if they just solve the equation, then it's all going to be okay. But the fact is, golf is a lot more chaotic than that. It's not possible to make things black and white in golf. And this kind of going back and forth between those two poles, it seems to me, is like a big part of just being a golfer. And I guess that's not really a question. It's more of a thesis, but I wonder if it brings anything to mind for you.
Well, it does. And I would say what you're describing is very much a real thing for some golfers. And especially in the modern context, like, you know, Tiger, it's all about the W. But for Peter Teravainen and my friends Billy Britton and Mike Donald and various others, it wasn't all about the win. They weren't going to win. Maybe occasionally they might win. They wanted to play good enough golf that they could stay out there. So to play good enough golf to stay out there was to constantly try to solve the various and many mysteries of the game, like where should the right thumb be when you're putting. I can't forget Al Geiberger late in his life. Oh, you won't be able to see this. Well, they see this, you know, and he had his right thumb right down the shaft. And then he says to me one day, you see that Corey, this is in 85, and Corey Pavin was putting great. I mean, he always putted great. You see that Corey Pavin? He's got his right thumb here, and he moved it a quarter inch. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. That will make the difference, because in his mind, maybe it would make the difference. Now, Al Geiberger was a very accomplished player. And, you know, he was a mega, mega talent. The guys, Peter was not a mega, mega talent, but I don't think it was unsettling. I think it was like, man, I'm making a living playing professional golf, and I'm going to keep at this mystery of it. And there was a tremendous, I want to use the word joy, but it's not like, isn't this all great? It was more like deeply satisfying to be in this really interesting thing where you're trying to figure it out. And I can very much relate to it, because I'm trying to do this, you know, here at 63, you know, I'm a lousy writer, I'm a terrible reporter, but I'm going to try to get better at it. That's my MO. And, you know, I think Peter would have said about the same thing.
You mentioned that Teravainen was pretty frugal. His frugality led you to one particularly interesting situation. I'm sure many interesting situations, but the one I'm thinking of is the night on the caddy bus. Can you give me a few snatches of your memory from the night on the caddy bus?
Garrett, I thought you might go for another one, which I'm going to get to in one quick second. Yes, sure. There was anything to save a night's, Peter called hotels in the kind of British tradition, digs. Now, digs always cost you at least 30 pounds, and he was not fussy at all. He often said where the caddies did, 30 pounds even then was not a lot of money. But if you could transport yourself and not have to pay for digs at the same time, it was a two for one. So an overnight train or overnight ferry or an overnight bus ride would be ideal. So at one point, Christine and I were going from, I think, Spain to a port of Portugal, definitely to a port of Portugal, by way of an overnight caddy bus. And there were 60 caddies in various states of impairment on the bus. One caddy spouse, my wife, Christine, and one player, Peter. He was fine with it. We got to the border crossing of Spain and Portugal. We couldn't get in because the border wasn't open yet. Peter was rolling with it all. And I don't know. It's astounding to think about it now. But there was a movie showing Herbie Rides the Bus or something like that. Something like that. No, it wasn't Herbie Rides the Bus. Some Herbie-type, VW-type bug movie. And it was on. It was showing again and again. Of course, it was not what the caddies were looking for. And there were, you know, things got very chaotic on this bus ride. But, you know, the things you do when you're young and dumb are quite amazing. But there was another time. At one point, I had a car, and Christine and I had rented a car on a long-term basis, and Peter did not. And we were staying in some modest hotel, and I think this is Monte Carlo, and Peter was staying in the same hotel. And Peter left a note on our door. Now, I'm the guy with the car, but he is the boss. And the note says the following: Mike, I want to eat breakfast at the club, so we'll leave at 7:30. Pete. Or we'll leave at 7. So, but our tea time was like 9:30, so it was like all for his convenience. So Christine writes back on the note, Pete, the car leaves at 8. If you want to go earlier, bus it. You know, this is not precise, this is from memory, but it's in the book. And but another example of how Peter thought and also his frugality. But his frugality actually made the whole thing possible. You know, if he spent, he would have been spending into debt, and he can't play good golf in debt. So I think, you know, it was a way of life for him, frugality. But also prevented him, he was able to make more money than he spent, even when he was 100th on the Order of Merit, as they charmingly called it there. So it worked hugely to his advantage to live the way he lived.
I wonder if your experience as a caddy has bled into your career as a journalist. You know, you've, at this point, by the time you finished caddying for Tara Vanen in 1991, you had put in some hours as a caddy. You had also caddied, I believe, on the PGA Tour or in the U.S. somewhere. Right. And so when you're inside the ropes at a golf tournament, do you think you look at the action somewhat differently than an ordinary journalist might because you have had this experience on the bag?
I wouldn't want to compare myself to anybody else, but I would definitely say that the caddying that I've done has enriched every aspect of my writing life and for this conversation, particularly my golf writing. Part of it is, to this day, I still have friends and great friends who are caddies themselves. If I see Mike Cowan, Fluff, you know, have a little chat with him, Lawrence McKay, Joe LaCava, various others that I've known going back, you know, in some of these cases, to the mid-80s or maybe even the late 70s. And they know golf at a level that I'll never know it because they have so much vast experience. But also, I think having caddied in professional events, I think I understand, because I've seen it at such close range, the challenges of what it's like to try to, to play the last three holes and even to make a cut. That challenge for Peter Teravainen, you know, or Brad Faxon or whomever it might be, is nearly identical to Colin Montgomery trying to play the last three and one under to win a tournament. And it's nerve wracking. It's really, really difficult. Getting to the house, getting to 36 holes, getting to 72 holes, is really, really astoundingly difficult thing to do. And the closer, if you watch from TV, you have one sense of it. If you watch as a spectator, you have another. And if you watch as a caddy, you have yet another. And of course, the player would have yet another. So yes, I think that's been very, very helpful. And then Tom Watson, has written, I think, a book, and he's definitely talked about it a lot over the course of his life. And Bones McKay is a TV commentator. Did the same. What I'm about to say is the lie, and Tiger was the master of this, the lie dictates everything. You really don't know what you're going to do with the shot until you see the lie, how it's actually sitting. But you could extrapolate from that just a little bit and say the lie is also, of course, it's the wind and the weather, but it's also how you're feeling, where you stand on the leaderboard, where you stand on the money list, blah, 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 blah. The lie is the here and now. And the here and now is one of the single most fascinating things about golf, because, and Nicklaus wrote about this forever, or said this forever, you're only going to have one chance in your life at this exact shot, this time and place. And what are you going to do with it? And after what you do with it, you're going to have to live with it. So like Tiger was absolutely brilliant at get really absorbed, and all these golfers are, but Tiger was so obvious you could actually see it. Get super absorbed in this moment. What am I going to do with it? And then let's say the result is not what you want. Then there's going to be this moment of anger and feeling unworthy. And then you must let that go so you can do it all over again, here and now, here and now, here and now. Now, when you're on the practice tee or the practice round or something else, then it's all sort of future looking. having learned something from your past all the while. But it's an endless thing in golf. And here I am at 63 trying to get better, or trying to hang on. I'm not sure which. But I think it's true for all of us. So like Updike wrote, golf of games is the one in which, you know, the walls between the earthly world and the supernatural rub thinnest. That's not at all an exact quote. And that's true. But it's also the game in which, like, the amateur experience and the pro experience are really identical. Because everything that I just said for the best players in the world, it's also true for us. And I think that's why, you know, the Fried Egg exists and Golf Club Atlas exists and people want to read and learn more about the game because, well, really, in a sentence, it's just endlessly interesting.
Why don't we transition into talking about your own game, your own golf in Scotland after you decided to leave the European Tour and Peter Teravainen moved on to a new caddy, which you write about in the book, and you felt a little pang of jealousy, which was a charming moment. But it was time for you to play some golf of your own in Scotland. You mentioned Michael Murphy's book, Golf in the Kingdom, earlier, and his great character, Shivas Irons. You didn't have a Shivas Irons in mind when you went to Scotland, but you ended up sort of finding one in the flesh. How did you learn about John Stark?
Great question. And if I could just brag about Mike for a minute, Mike's in his mid-90s. I would say he's a friend, but I'm honored to say that. And he wrote a little introduction to the new version. I mean, it's so brilliant. It says so much in about 300 words. You can't believe it. He is an astounding person. He's the full DNA package. In his mid-50s, early 50s, he could run like a 430 mile. I mean, that's mind-boggling. Tremendously handsome and articulate and smart person. And he has this ability to see through things in an incredibly deep way. Alan Shipnuck and Jeff Ogilvie and I did a podcast with him maybe about a year and a half ago. And he was so astoundingly interesting. But anyway, so I want to tip my hat to Michael Murphy and his great, great invention of Shivas Irons, who combines different characters from real life into a fictional character. And yes, I very much did have the idea. I had no idea who the person would be, but if I could find my own Shivas Irons, wouldn't that be great? And I went to Peter Allis. Oddly, how I don't, he, you know, everything was more casual then. You know, I was a caddy working at a tournament and Peter was there. For those who don't know, Peter Allis was the great voice of golf for the BBC for about 110 years. And he's in the World Golf Hall of Fame. And if you ever want to see something really funny, look up his Hall of Fame induction speech. It's priceless, funny, and very droll. But anyway, I introduced myself to Peter, and Peter said, look up this guy, John Stark, in Crieff. That's all he said. I knew nothing about him. And I think I wrote a letter to John Stark in Crieff and asked if I could come see him. And he said yes. And for whatever reason, Stark and I hit it off, or he took a liking to me, or he could see my desperation, probably a combination of all those things, and my eagerness and my just desire to sort of learn the game anew, learn it from a Scottish perspective. And that conversation with Peter Allis enriched the rest of my life, because meeting Stark enriched the rest of my life and has enriched my golf to this day.
I have a sense that John Stark represents a tradition in the game that is not, it hasn't gone away completely, but it's more rare to find now. How would you describe the tradition in golf that John Stark represented, the lineage that he was bringing to bear in his conversations with you?
Well, it's everything, really, because it, you know, he would say, you know, golf, the swing starts from the ground up. Golf starts from the ground up. Now, so much of golf is, what do you see from a video camera? What do you see looking down at a golfer and down at a golf course? And his whole view was the game and the people who play it come from the ground up. You know, I wrote another book called The Ball in the Air, and I got that phrase from Billy Harmon, Claude Harmon's son and Butch Harmon's kid brother. There were four Harmon brothers and two sisters, and Billy was the youngest of the brothers. But their thing was, that ball in the air, what is it doing and what can I learn from it? And also in Stark, not so much Stark the professional, but Stark the person who loved golf, it really was, this is like a cliche of Scottish golf, but it's a good cliche because it's true. It really was about the match, the camaraderie, appropriateness of how serious, don't take the game seriously. Don't take yourself so seriously. And part of that very much is the pace of play. Because if you're not taking it so seriously, you will play faster. And I know a lot of my American friends that I play with think that I play ridiculously fast. I think I just play appropriately fast, but I realize I'm out of step with the rest of the culture. But in Scotland, I wasn't out of step with the rest of the culture. And as a matter of fact, on a late afternoon golf game that began at 4:30 one day at the old course, on a busy day, we played in 3.5 hours. I don't think that would happen today. So Stark just does, you know, represent. He comes right out of the Hogan tradition in his own way. You know, figure it out for yourself. And I would add to that, and don't take yourself so damn seriously. It's a game.
Tell me about making good sounds.
Making good sounds was the very thing that led me, amazingly, to have a golf game with John Updike. And I'm not name dropping, although I just did name drop.
I definitely want to hear about this. Name drop away. This is fascinating to me.
So what he believed, you know, the starting point for Stark, by the way, I met Sandy Lyle's golf pro father during this trip as well. It was the same for Mr. Lyle, was that the golf swing began with rhythm. And a golf swing that didn't have rhythm was not going to be a successful golf swing. And Stark's point was that there are different types of rhythm, and the shaft will make different sounds based on the rhythm that at which you are swinging. And depending on your athleticism and strength and age and lots of other things, you will have a different rhythm. And even Ernie Els and Tiger in their prime, they hit the ball the same distance, but they had different rhythms. So he wanted you to think about the whoosh sound that the shaft makes that would have really several different types of pitches, as he described it, and be aware of that, and be aware of the air in your lungs as you're making a backswing. And to this day, I try to do that. This is really name-droppy, but it's true. So I had a pal, Roger Angel. I'd met him through baseball and some other things, and he sent the book to John Updike. This is my memory of it. And John Updike wrote me a note out of the blue. And part of his draw to Golf in the Kingdom, excuse me, he did love Golf in the Kingdom, so that was kind of a funny mistake, to this book that we're talking about, To the Links Lane, was that he liked Stark and he liked what Stark was teaching. And he invited me up for a golf game at his home club, Myopia Hunt. And by the way, to speak of, you know, different eras, he invited me to this golf game by postcard. He set up the date by postcard. Everything, he never gave me his phone number, and I certainly never asked for it. Everything, no internet, no email, of course, no texting, of course. Everything was by postcard. So I've got a collection of postcards from John Updike that's this thick to set up this golf game, and then the aftermath of the golf game. Anyway, I'm, you know, one of the thrills of my life. And then in this new version of To the Links Lane, I've got an afterword, and I describe that little bit with Updike.
Yeah, it's a wonderful little scene, and it's funny because another great golf writer, James Dodson, has written about his own round with John Updike. I forget which book it was in, but that's a very memorable essay/chapter in that book where he talks about how John Updike goes about playing golf, which I never really heard about before. I'll figure out which book it was in, but in any case, let me just read you something that John Stark said to you, and that you transcribed into the Lynxland. He says, "You," and by you he means Americans here, "you showed us that there's money in golf. That had never occurred to us. The money has corrupted us all of us, myself included. Once you start making it, it's a damn cancer, the money is. You start thinking, what can I do to make more money? In my generation, we went into golf with no expectation of wealth. The golf alone sustained us." What does that make you think about now, given the current state of the professional game particularly?
It was deep. It was deeply true then, and it's only more true now. And that, and Stark saw the handwriting on the wall, and I don't think there's any question but that that he's correct, and it hasn't helped the game at all.
All right, let's talk about the reception up to the Lynxland and the effect that it had on you. We've already discussed Updike read it, and I think that, you know, after you published this book, that there was certainly a number of perhaps unexpected things happened for you. What's your memory of the initial reception of the book? How did people react to it right out of the gate?
Well, it was lovely. Golf Digest so generously excerpted it in not one but two issues. As you were saying, Garrett, earlier, you know, it's got the in and the out portion, the European Tour portion and the Scotland portion. And Jerry Tardy, the editor of Golf Digest, very kindly saw that the excerpts really needed two goes at it to make it work. I was a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer at the time. This is some years before I joined Sports Illustrated. And that helped greatly. And then the artful way that he did it, and Golf and his colleagues at Golf Digest did it, was that it gave you a little bit, but not the whole thing, where you might actually want to go out and read the book. And this is, of course, in the early 90s. So in that period, people would actually, if they liked the book, would write you letters, like the one I got from Updike. But I must have hundreds of letters at home, and I haven't thrown them out, and I wouldn't throw them out, from just readers who liked the book and got something out of it. Now, two of them happened to be sort of noteworthy because they were former USGA presidents, and they wanted to find – there's this secret course in the book called Achnafri that Stark took me to. They wanted to find their way to Achnafri. They did find their way to Achnafri, and then they wrote me about the experience. So that was, you know, quite an amazing thing to hear from these sort of lions of the game, Bill Campbell and Sandy Tatum. But most of the people were like, they wanted practical advice about going to Scotland, or they just wanted to share about their own experience in the game or their own John Stark. So anyways, it was just a lovely thing, and goes on to this day. Absolutely not a week goes by where I don't hear from some person I don't know, but the reader feels connected to me and I to them because of how they're writing and what they're writing. Where now for 30 plus years, first by letter and now by email, I just hear directly from readers who are touched by early marriage and the promise that it brings and the simplicity that it brings. Golf in a more simple state. Tara Vanen as a character, we've been talking about him. Stark as a character, we've been talking about him. An approach to life where, of course, you need money. We all need money. We all need to eat and sleep and health and be clothed and the rest. But it's not obsessively more, not this attitude of more, 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 which, you know, just raised by the parents I was raised with, I never had. So it's been an incredibly enriching experience to have this relationship with readers for a long time now.
Right. And I would say that part of the charisma of the book is the places that you talk about. You mentioned Achnafree. Now, I haven't asked you questions about the various courses that you went to in Scotland intentionally, because I want people to read the book and discover those places for themselves and find out what you think about them. I think some mystery should be left there, but it should be clear that that's a big part of the second part of the book and a big part of its appeal. This book really has lived on. It's one that people kind of talk about in hushed tones and give to each other. For a while in recent years, it was a little bit hard to find or a little bit hard to find affordably, and people would kind of pass it between each other. Why do you think it has had this effect when other golf books, I'm not going to say equally good golf books, but very worthy golf books have not lived on in the same way? Why do you think To the Links Land has stuck?
It's such a generous question. Garrett, I'm thoroughly enjoying this conversation. I've got two problems. Problem number one is a tea time. Problem number two is a computer that's down to 4%.
Oh no.
If we suddenly die, you'll know why, but I think we're okay. And I'm happy to continue this later if you wish to. The book is overrated. I'm well aware of that. I'm very critical of my own writing. I look at it and it's like, ugh, you know, I would do it so differently. But I think about everything that I write. But the book does capture, and I think this is true of every piece of writing and movies and other things, there is an underlying spirit to it of, you know, it's called To the Links in a Golfing Adventure. There is an underlying spirit of adventure. And many, many people are afraid to get in touch with their own adventure spirit. Even though almost all people do have an adventure spirit, I was very lucky to have the parents I had because they encouraged my brother and me both to explore our own adventures. Not really wording that correctly, but I'm sure you get the idea. So I think the reader is coming away from that. Sometimes not even people who are interested in golf at all. But I have picked up on that from readers over the years.
So Michael, in this book, your mission, as you stated it in the first chapter, was to search for the primal heart of golf. And I think it's, you know, it's a happy book. It's a hopeful book in the sense that you sort of discover it in a lot of different ways. You go looking for the primal heart of golf and you find it. Now, back then you did it by following the European tour and playing Scottish golf. I have a hard time imagining what the present day version of this adventure would be. Do you think it's harder to find the primal heart of golf now than it was back in 1991?
Really good question. Probably yes, but definitely doable. You know, I'm here at this Epsom Tour event, at this just plain Jane, very nice middle-class country club course in Winter Haven, Florida. And like the second I rolled in here, I was happy. Because every one of these girls, women in this field, they're on that same path as Peter Teravainen. And, you know, there's a local Dodge dealer has his car out in front. Achnafree, you know, the six-hole course that Stark took me to in a wilderness, that's not there. But other things are there. And, you know, there's great public golf courses everywhere you go. And I think it's there, but I think you have to define the terms for yourself and for your era. And I feel like I've stayed and connected to my own primal search. You know, I don't play these Ping I2s that I play to be eccentric. I play them because they make me happy. And I know what they can do. And I know what they can't do. So yes, I think the answer is yes. But it's going to be different because nothing in life is stagnant.
Michael, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Thanks for the great questions. This is thoroughly enjoyable.
This episode of the Friday Golf Podcast was produced by Meg Atkins. Thank you, Meg. If you would like to support Friday Golf on a different level, then consider joining Club TFE. Go to thefriedegg.com/membership and see what it's all about there. But a big part of the offering in Club TFE is exclusive content, like a weekly in-depth course profile with a write-up about the golf course and great imagery, drone shots, and illustrations from our team. So that's the kind of stuff that you get in Club TFE. This is truly, I think, thoughtful content about the game. So if that sounds appealing to you, again, thefriedegg.com/membership is the place to go. Thank you for listening to this episode, and we'll be back again soon with another.